Sheffield Live. Made in Sheffield, made by you.
If you like rock in all its forms, you will love Glory Days. You can listen to us locally on 93.2 FM and on the telly, and anywhere in the world on sheffieldlive.org. What do you think, Don? You know what? I think he likes it. That's Glory Days, every Monday 1 till 3 here on Sheffield Live. Bosh, bosh. Oops, I've had an accident.
Hello, I'm Harry Wilburn. I present Steel & Wire every Wednesday, 10 a.m. Americana, bluegrass, American roots, and more. Lots more. Lots of guests, lots of local music and musicians. That's Steel & Wire, Wednesday, 10 a.m.
You're listening to fabulous Harry Wilburn on Steel & Wire.
It's time to open the music box. Join me, Steve Roden, every Thursday morning between 10 and 12 for music from the 40s to the 90s from my own music collection. Songs I've grown up with, ones I am sure you will enjoy hearing again. Hope to see you then.
If you love new music and you want to discover the best new artists out there, then tune into The Backroom with me, Paddy. I'll be playing the best of new indie, electro, EDM and punk and showcasing new Sheffield talent. Also music news, local and national gig guide and new album releases. So tune into The Backroom every Thursday night between 6 and 7 p.m. here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM.
This is Sheffield Live.
N-E-X.
Good morning and welcome to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire or sheffieldlive.org. Talking about science in all its different forms every Saturday morning, 11 till 12. You've got Julian Paul here in the studio. Later on in the show, we'll be talking to our PG. Guess what he's talking about this week? Yes, it's bits and pieces. That means he hasn't decided quite yet. If you've never tuned in before, we do have guest speakers on most weeks. This week and indeed every fourth Saturday of the month, it's Chris Dale. All being well next week. And every first Saturday of the month, we should have Phil Muffet on from the Mexburg and Swinton Astronomical Society. All being well, we're going to have Chris on the line right now. He's going to be talking about e-numbers.
Science.
Good morning, Chris.
Morning, Life Science Radio.
Morning, everyone. What's it like to be on first, Chris?
Well,
different.
I'd just like to say sorry to my friend PG, but I'll be as quick as I can.
He's all right. You can have as long as you want, Chris. Excellent. So for the past, my word, year, more than a year, you've been talking.
2 years now.
It is ultra-processed foods, wow. All the additives, what it does to our health, what it does to, you know, everything else. And we're going to talk in particular about all the different e-numbers, because there are lots of them.
Yeah, I just basically thought we could run through exactly what e-numbers are and then maybe highlight a few and just maybe talk them through. But I think the thing that I found quite shocking when you asked me to have a look at this was how many e-numbers there are.
It is really worrying. And they are sort of officially and registered and everything, aren't they, all these bizarre e-numbers?
Yeah, I put together a list of e-numbers and it amounts to 28 pages.
Yes, so I haven't printed them all out, but I can see them on the screen. Yeah,
Can't pronounce any of them though, can we?
No, we're going to have trouble pronouncing these. This is one we could do with PG actually.
So, e-numbers, what I thought I'd do is just start off and just explain what they are. So foods sold without sort of throughout Europe have had a full list of ingredients labelling since about the mid-1980s. And these include standard codes, E numbers, that effectively E stands for Europe, that accurately describes these additives. And these E numbers are numbers are used in other areas like Australia and New Zealand, but they don't have the E in front of them. So the E stands for Europe. Now, there are also categories of E numbers that are quite specific. So E numbers 100 to 199, so that's 99 different ones, are generally food colourings. E200 to 299 are mainly preservatives and acids. E300 to 399 are mainly antioxidants and acid regulators. And an acid regulator manages the pH level in your food. E400 to 499 includes emulsifiers, stabilizers, and thickeners. E500 to E599 includes anti-caking agents and acidity regulators again. E600s are mainly flavour enhancers. And then we go up to E900s that include sweeteners, glazing agents, foaming agents and gases. And then we have E1000s, and that's other additives.
Oh, my word. Do you know, it's making me feel ill. Anyway, foaming agents.
Yeah, no idea what they are.
I think you get them in toothpaste.
Toothpaste, of course yes. You do, yeah.
Yeah, that is, it's quite shocking, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. So these E numbers, so basically is an ingredient list on your packaged food. And it replaces the chemical or common name for the food additives. So it just says E100 rather than the very long chemical name or whatever. The food additives have been used, however, for centuries. And I think this is really important. So the ancient Romans, for instance, used saffron, salt, vinegar to either colour their food or preserve it. Because obviously in those days they didn't have refrigeration and that sort of thing. So as I say, these sort of preservatives have been used for years. And regardless of what many believe, and me included, and I guess you included as well,
yes,
Julian Paul,
definitely.
E on food labels doesn't necessarily stand for evil. E numbers, which represent, you know, the food additives, can be both good and bad.
But I think the key is it's not easy to distinguish that on a packet.
Well, no, because you don't know what the E numbers
are. No, you don't know what they are.
There are totally natural harmless additives such as saffron, which is E164, paprika, E160, vitamin C, E300, or sodium bicarbonate, E500. But of course, how would you know that they were harmless?
No, you just assume, I'd assume anything that had an E number was synthetic.
No, and that's not the case. That's not the case.
So this is what we learn, but it makes it very difficult to make a considered choice when you're in the supermarket.
But what you could do, though, is print off the list of E numbers that I've had and walk around the supermarket with that.
But then, Chris, you'd never come out of the supermarket with anything other than fresh fruit, vegetables.
Meat, maybe.
But this is really the crux of the issue, isn't it? If you buy fresh fruit and vegetables and meats in their basic state and you make your meals at home, you're not going to have this problem at all.
Absolutely. And when we get on a little bit later, I'm going to say highlight some of the E numbers and explain exactly what they do and how they're used. But whilst there are good E numbers, there are also bad E numbers. And health specialists around the world are becoming increasingly convinced that non-natural additives in processed foods are linked to the rise in children's allergies. And remember, we talked about that a few months ago. And particular attention has been paid to infants and children's products because their immature organs are less efficient at removing toxins from their system. And even that's really worrying as well, because why are we giving this E numbers and ultra processed food to children? However, despite the mounting evidence, there are very few restrictions in place on the food manufacturers in the UK, and of course, the same in the USA as well. What was interesting, though, when I started to research this, was how an E number randomly could be, let's say, banned in Northern Ireland, but not England, Wales, or Scotland, or how an E number can be banned in Belgium, but not in France or Germany. So there seems to be this sort of complete sort of random process, if you like, for saying what is harmful and what isn't harmful. And some countries think it is, some countries think it isn't. So some countries have displayed a more responsible attitude and have banned certain E-numbers. And other countries, particularly in Eastern Europe and the USA, they haven't banned any at all. And it's free for people to use whichever E-numbers they want.
It's interesting because I read quite a while back now, I think Marmite is banned in a certain country. It might be Denmark or somewhere, because they said there's too many additives in it, too many things in it.
Yep.
And you just, well.
There you go. So you were talking about buying fresh fruit, fresh food and that sort of thing, but obviously not everybody has the time to cook. Not everybody is able to cook. Not everybody, you know. So I think what I'm basically trying to say is that some people rely on having food that has preservatives and things like that in it, because people go to the supermarket, they buy their food, and it might need to last them for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
So there is a place for them, and we've discussed that again before. But the interesting things with the E-numbers is that they're also used to create flavour. So it's not just about preserving and colours and all the rest of it. They actually use that sort of mix of E-numbers to create hyper-palatable food and ready meals. And these sort of food and these flavours can be engineered in the same way as any other junk food. We have spoken about hyper-palatable food before, which has this very specific combination of fat, sugar, sodium and carbohydrate. So think of something like a burger that makes them artificially rewarding to eat and harder to stop consuming. And I think we've said before that in nature, nothing has that combination of fat, sugar and salt.
No.
So it's artificially created to make humans utterly defenseless and, so that we eat more.
But it's an absolutely, that's a really key point, isn't it, about it? You would never find that mix in a natural food source.
No, absolutely
not. It would
not.
Be one thing or the other.
It's created
it?
By the food market to make us want to eat it, to crave to eat it, and to eat more of it, because that's how they make their money.
And what I've noticed as well, Chris, because we're like you now, we do scrutinise anything we buy, and we're slowly eliminating everything. So your diet's improving, we're losing weight, we're hungry all the time. But, you know, a lot of products I've noticed now, they seem to be healthy, but then there's one word that says flavourings.
Yeah.
Hiding what must be a multitude of sins.
Well, they have to put the E numbers onto the ingredients list if they're using them where they say flavourings. But of course, we don't know what they are, do we?
No. So that I've noticed that as though that's a cover all for A, the list would be too long. But it's sort of implying if you don't pick up on that, that says to me that there's a lot of different combination of E numbers. We say about engineering that food,
yes, that's
in
correct.
Those products.
And the classic for that, Julie, is crisps and things like Wotsits. That sort of where they use specific combinations to sort of make you crave to eat that crisp. So what I thought I'd also do is just sort of remind people what E-numbers are used for. And then I thought we could just maybe pick some at random and just talk through them. So E-numbers basically are that they're there to preserve ready meals, giving them a longer shelf life. They're used to even stop things like soup separating whilst they're on the shelf.
Yeah.
Because obviously if you make your own soup at home, if you leave it, it sort of, you know, you need to remix it, don't you? Well, they have special E numbers that stop that. They have E numbers that are used to make gravies and sauces thicker, and they are used to replace costly ingredients like sugar and natural oils, or used to make things sweeter.
Or even even to replace fruits and flavors. So it's not, you wouldn't have a real raspberry, you'd just have a synthetic raspberry.
Right. So sometimes they put raspberry in, but actually it's E numbers that are combined to make something taste like raspberry, even, and there's no raspberry in it whatsoever.
No, I know.
So it's used to enhance the colour of food and entice us humans to buy things, and we'll talk about that in a minute as well. It's used to make ingredients go further, and for instance, it's used to preserve the lifespan of bread and to make it softer. And just to put an example on, if you were to make a lemon drizzle cake and buy the ingredients from a supermarket, it would probably cost us around £4. To make the same lemon drizzle cake in a factory, the ingredients cost around 22 pence.
That probably tells you all you need to know.
That tells you all you need to know about mass-produced food. So, are you happy just to, if we just pick some random E numbers and maybe talk through what they are?
Yes, indeed.
Okay, so I'm going to start. So I've got about six or seven just to run through. We've got E110, which is sunset yellow, SCF, orange yellow S. That's how it's described. And that is a synthetic coal tar dye, yellowing colouring, and can be used and combined with other E numbers. And this is often found in soft drinks, cakes, biscuits, puddings, meat products, sauces, tinned and packaged convenience food, and confectionery. And you're going to ask me, what is a synthetic coal tar? And it's an artificial colouring agent combining toluene, xylene, benzene, which are obtained from the distillation of bituminous coal.
You just can't believe it, actually, can you?
No. I mean, who would have known that?
Well, you wouldn't, and you wouldn't even think that consuming that could be safe, and yet it's given an E number, therefore it's somehow been approved, hasn't it?
It has, yeah. Now, the other one, which was again a colouring one, was called E120, and this, I can't even pronounce this.
Cochineal.
Carminic acid
and carmines, yeah.
So this is a natural red colour obtained from egg yolk and dried insects.
Yes, it's the beetle, cochineal beetle.
That's right. But
it is, yeah.
I never realised there was any red in an egg yolk.
Well, me neither, but I did know about the beetle's business because that was used in ancient times to give that
you
red.
You can manufacture, so there are two E20, so one can be manufactured and one is natural. So the natural one is obviously more expensive than the manufactured one. And basically, this is a red colour that's used in food and especially sweet. So you look at your Haribos and that sort of thing.
Mm. Yeah.
And that gives the very bright colours that are very attractive to children.
Yeah.
Now, the next one, I think this might be one that you've spotted before. This is the E142, which is called Green S. And this is a synthetic coal tar dye, same as the one before, but this one's green in colour. And this is used to restore the expected green colour to things like tinned mushy peas. They add it to asparagus soup to make it a lot greener. They use it in lemon and lime drinks and jellies and even mint sauce.
Yeah, to make it, because otherwise it would be quite yellow. And on that note, we used to buy, and I will name the brand because I thought, well, you know, it's Bachelors and it's mushy peas and we used to love them. And we thought, well, they've got to be like, you know, really good for you, haven't they? Because they're peas. And we looked at the tin and the colouring, well, it was E101 in there, but also the colouring was E133, which is described as brilliant blue, FCF. And when you Googled it, it's sort of, it's a bit like the coal tar business. It's like an off...
Industrial waste.
So we've just stopped buying them. But this is it. You just, why, if they didn't put that colour in the peas, they'd look yellowy, wouldn't they? rather than green.
What's wrong with that?
Well, exactly. Exactly. But, you know, if they took that colour out, I would eat them without that colour. But isn't it interesting what we've become used to?
Absolutely. Right, I've got four more before I leave you. We've got E210, which is benzoic acid. This occurs naturally in cherry bark, raspberries, tea,
anise,
cassia bark.
Yeah.
And it acts as a preservative and antioxidant, most frequently in fruit products, soft drinks, pickled products, and salad dressing. And again, this can be made synthetically, so chemically for commercial use, because doing that is cheaper than using the natural ingredients. Mm. The other one, so E1105 is something called lysozyme. And the reason I put this in is this one's caught me out. It's a natural enzyme found in tears, saliva, blood, sweat, breast milk, and commercially purified from white eggs. And as you know, I have an allergy to eggs. And lysozyme is used as a preservative in infant nutrition products and cheese products, and particularly cheese products that are made in a factory as opposed to being made naturally. And I had some Parmesan cheese with lysozyme in, and I wasn't very well for a couple of hours afterwards, let's put it that way.
I read an article recently that said if you're going to buy cheese, make sure you buy a lump of cheese. You know, a piece of cheese. Don't buy one that's been done anything to. But it's an interesting one. But you wouldn't expect that, would you?
No, well, we just bought, because we know that Parmesan cheese doesn't have any egg product in. But the one, the cheaper Parmesan that is made in factories, they add this lysozyme. And obviously we didn't know.
Mm.
So that's one for, that's definitely one for people with egg allergies to know about.
But if it just said E1105A, that's a very big number for an E number, which is quite frightening how many there is, as we talked about. But how would you know that you were going to be allergic to that? You wouldn't, would you?
You wouldn't, no. Well, the only way that you find out is by eating it. So there you go.
But then again, you have to isolate that impact, don't you? You could have eaten something else.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's true. So we've got two more. We've got E320, which is butylated hydroxyanisol.
I think it's hydroxyanisol. Butylated hydroxyanisol. Oh, my gosh.
Which is an antioxidant manufactured synthetically for use alone or with other E numbers, and is often found in chips, potato snacks, biscuits, pastry, bottled sauces, and fried foods. Who would have known that?
Well, who would want to eat it? What's to the point?
And then last but not least, I've gone for E420, which is a sweetener. It's called sorbitol.
Yeah.
And it's a sugar alcohol produced from glucose. It's less quickly absorbed than sugar, so it's often used as a sweetener and also used as a humectant. A humectant.
Yes.
And a humectant is something that retains or preserves moisture and is often used in skin lotion. But so sorbitol is often used in dietary confectionery preserves, so things like marmalade, biscuits, cakes, and soft drinks. But it does say it may have a laxative effect if in large doses. So, I mean, you know, it's not just about what you're eating, it's also about what you're putting on your skin as well.
Well, in your mouth, you know, we did talk about toothpastes.
Yeah.
Sodium lauryl sulfate is in just about every toothpaste.
So basically, yeah. I've picked sort of six or seven out of the list. And like I say, we've got 28, 29 pages worth, so we could have picked other ones. Some of the ones on the list that I sent you have been banned, but once again, I come on the Live Science Show and I sound like I'm the real miserable Grim Reaper bringing all this bad news.
Well, people, you know, it's a slow learning curve. You know, we started this journey probably a year or so ago, maybe longer than that, and we've slowly eradicated to a certain degree almost everything we can out of our diet. If we buy crisps, we just buy plain crisps.
Yeah.
You know, check the label. It should just be oil and salt. Some might argue that's not good for you anyway, but I want a bag of crisps every now and again. So it's about choosing, you know, the least worst option. But I would say, would you agree, Chris, that advice would be to people, you've got to start somewhere. You maybe think about your favourite product. If you love Watsits, just have a look on the back of a packet of Watsits and go and work out what's in that bag and then think, maybe I won't eat that anymore.
Well, the other day I went to a supermarket and had a meal deal on for a sandwich, a drink and a bag of crisps. And I looked at the ingredients in all of the, and I just said, we're not eating that. Because there must have been about 17, 18 E numbers just in the sandwich.
Yeah.
Yeah. Besides anything else. So
it's not good.
What we do now, as long as you're not intolerant to cheese or gluten or whatever, if we want, instead of buying a sandwich, if we're on the go, we'll buy some freshly baked bread from a supermarket and buy a piece of cheese, you know, and that's it.
Best thing. It's interesting because do you remember one of our very close friends, Dan Hennessy, came on the program
yes.
and spoke about his food journey and how he'd lost so much weight by just eradicating this stuff.
Yeah.
So we might need to get him on in a few months and see where he's up to.
But I would say as well, Chris, we have, by changing our diet and eating less processed food, we have definitely lost weight.
Fantastic.
And I think it's because the body cannot really digest all this stuff.
Yeah.
And what was I going to say as well? What we've noticed is because we've eradicated a lot of additives, because there's a lot of hidden stuff you wouldn't know about. Once you start eradicating processed food, when you do eat processed food, a bit of it, it makes you feel sort of strange.
Yeah, a lot of people have said that, and I'm going to confess that when I put the phone down to the Life Science Radio show today, my wife's just made me a big sausage sandwich.
Oh!
But as she made the bread.
No, but
just go and look at breads, a really naughty area for the amount of sugar and salt and preservatives in them.
Sausage sandwich sounds
great to us, Chris. Thanks so much, Chris. It's absolutely fascinating. You could
speak. Just remember though, some E numbers are good for you.
Yes, they are.
Natural.
Yeah,
not
brilliant.
All of them are bad.
Enjoy your sausage sandwich, Chris.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Gotta love.
Oh, cracking track there. That was Sold Me Down the River, live version by The Alarm. And we played that because we're talking to Chris Daly. He was giving a great chat there about E-numbers. Makes you think about what's in your cupboards. Go and have a look. Make a slow start, one thing at a time. If you're just tuning in, of course, listen to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire, or sheffieldlive.org, talking about science in all its different forms. Every Saturday, 11 till 12, we should have our PG on the line. Good morning, PG.
Good morning.
Oh, it's strange having you on at 11:30.
I'm always strange.
People are strange.
Well said.
Rather nice track that, by the Doors, actually. So what's caught your eye in the news this week, then?
Well, I sort of tie in with what Chris was talking about, because I actually saw a programme about Inside M&S, which was kind of interesting about how they do things. And one of the sections was about developing a new food product. And they were looking at a sort of a potted sweet, I think it was, with blueberries in. They were trying to get the blue colours that they wanted. So one of the additives that they turned to is a thing called spirulina.
Right.
You see that. It's a very vivid blue colouring algae product. And there's a plant that makes it, in Iceland. It uses geothermal sort of energy as part of the process to create this spirulina. And then they ship it all over the world for food processing, because it seems that where our natural sort of instinct is, you look at blue food and you go, yuck, there's not something not right about that. So they start to play around with that to introduce blue-coloured sweets for kids and blue-coloured various sort of products for adults, which are just challenging your preconceptions about what you're going to get. So the whole process that they went through with this new product was fine, but when they were getting to the latter stages, they were getting loads of samples and sample tasting them. And they're going, yeah, it's looking all right, but it just doesn't quite taste right. So they called in their sort of in-house chef and said, yeah, what can you do to make this taste all right? So he said, well, I think actually what I've done before is to add a dash of lemon juice. So they put some lemon juice in and said, oh, that's brilliant, that's great. So it's not always the sort of chemistry effect. It is a natural product that they add to sort of tweak the taste. But just the whole process of designing food just gives you the background to what a lot of the additives and things are for, extending shelf life and giving sort of a taste and the rest of it. But I just thought it was a very interesting program. I think it's on the BBC, if you want to go back and dig into it. Could be ITV.
To be fair, I think Marks and Spencers are probably one ahead of the game, because they are replacing a lot of their additives with natural things like lemon juice, because it's a preservative. You know, going back to that old-fashioned, you know, Chris said the Romans were using things like saffron and paprika to colour the foods, you know. So, you know, it's you know, salt and vinegar, that's fine. That seems normal, doesn't it?
Well, I think, you know, it just underlines the thing that is the sort of old adage, is that you start to eat with your eyes. So, you know, they're trying to make things appealing. And I say, sometimes it's sort of challenging you. Preconceptions. And I mean, Heston Blumenthal
used to do lots of things where he'd make a Scotch egg, but it was actually a sweet dessert.
Yeah.
You know, and he'd make these dioramas with sort of vegetation and stuff made out of stuff like broccoli, and then scatter on stuff that looked like earth. And, you know, you sort of think, what a great experience digging into a plate full of dirt, you know. So, I mean, it's I think it's the whole thing about marketing. You know, they're trying to appeal to the eye, which is the sort of first thing that we do, and then trying to get the taste to catch up with it. And the other thing that I thought about is I noticed very early on when they introduced sorbitol to chewing gum as a sweetener, and a lot of the sort of sugar-free gums
were
using sorbitol. And now we're finding out that sorbitol's a low-level laxative that we find is quite hard to get out of our system. Mm. So there's accompanying weight loss, which is one of the things, again, that folks used to bandy around saying, well, if you chew gum, you know, it satisfies you, so you don't want to go and eat more. So it's amazing what little cul-de-sacs, avenues, and strange areas we get into with food. But also, sort of looking at food, one of the things we've touched on several times is good old bumblebees in the UK. And some of the news that's coming out now is that bumblebees are starting to nest in the winter, whereas historically they've hibernated through the winter. But because of the change in climate, at least two of the species of bumblebees native in the UK have been found nest building. Up in Aberdeen, they were spotted in mild weather over the Christmas break. So that's from a charity called Bug Life, and looking into caring for the bumblebees and other forms of insects that are good to us. The problem with this nest building is it's high risk because there's a shortage of flowers for the bees to collect nectar and pollen from, and then if the cold snap comes back like we are, it can be fairly disastrous for them. So,
indeed, the terrible storms that keep hitting.
Yeah, it's very bad, and I think also on that front, there's bad news for people because they've found out that ticks are starting to be active through this period because of the changing weather. So again, I think in Inverness, they found in an area of the city called Ness Castle on the 28th of December that ticks were active. So ticks are the things where the charity Lyme Disease Action was concerned about that situation, because obviously that's one of the things that ticks can introduce to humans. So not great news about the sort of changing weather, I think. And then I think the other thing that I looked at, if I can find my notes, is about Russia. And sadly, Russia's had an oil spill in the area just above Crimea in the Straits of Azov, I think it is. Two of these tankers that Russia has been moving crude oil around and have come to grief, run aground or had an accident. And they produced a massive oil slick in that area, which is seriously impacting Russian wildlife. I think things like 70 dolphins have died, 17,000 plus seabirds have been found dead, and it's progressively moving down through the straits into other areas. And it's a long, slow process if there's no sort of intervention to collect that spill. And we're talking about hundreds of tons of heavy oil product that's floating down that area. And it's the Kerch Strait, where the Kerch Bridge, which people have heard about, I think, from the Ukraine war sort of problem. But It's a big environmental disaster. You can find out more details on BBC Verified if you care to go and have a look. But one of the ships ran aground on the 15th of December, and then another one sank. And up to 5,000 tonnes of oil has now leaked, they say, across the Black Sea and into the Sea of Azov. It can be seen from space. We're talking about, say, a oil spill spreading 15 miles. It's also from the grounded tanker, there's 3 miles of leakage, which is going around. So, yeah, a sort of human-inflicted problem, I think, that realistically is going to cost nature. And as these things are cyclical, it's probably going to cost us all at some point.
Did it say why it happened?
Basically, it's this thing where Russia's using what they call a ghost fleet of old and under-maintained ships to bypass the sort of blockade of Russian oil. So they call these two ships Volgoneft 239, which is the one that ran aground, and Volgoneft 212, which sank. And these things are being sent around quite often without insurance to bypass the sort of blockade. So it's the first time fuel oil has been spilled in such quantities, said the head of science from Russian Academy of Sciences on the 17th of January. That was an interview for a Russian newspaper. And they said it could be more than twice the size of another disaster in the Strait back in 2007, which saw 1,600 tonnes of heavy fuel oil leak into the sea. Mm. So, not great news.
No.
I think Greenpeace are monitoring that, but say, if you want to read more in detail, then BBC Verified will give you the sort of rest of the background. I think another thing which sort of caught my eye is close to home, and I think folks will be used to hearing the name of Sellafield, the nuclear site up in Cumbria. And the UK is apparently getting ready to dispose of its radioactive plutonium stockpile, which is said to be the biggest in the world. And that's 140 tonnes of plutonium that are currently being stored at the site. And it's been stored as a potential fuel product for further nuclear reactors. And because it's stored that way, it's stored in a form that can be recycled and reused, but the containment that they're using can be attacked by the plutonium. So it's got to be continually processed and repotted in storage. So this is the deep underground storage of nuclear waste that's been talked about. I think we've touched on it in previous times. But storing it in its current form, which is a highly radioactive material, is expensive and difficult, needs to be frequently repackaged, and it's got to be guarded by armed police. Because yeah, it's a dangerous commodity to say, oh, that costs taxpayers more than £70 million per year. So the move is that they'll actually encapsulate this material in something like ceramic or glass. And it's actually Dr. Lewis Blackburn from the University of Sheffield said the plutonium could be converted into a ceramic material, which, while still radioactive, is solid and stable, and so it's deemed safe for this deep underground disposal. So I think they're talking about 1,000 metres underground storage of it, but just as a measure of the 140 tonnes, a typical bomb uses something like 8 kilograms of plutonium for the spherical sort of centre of the bomb, which is used. So that's why it's such a dangerous commodity to have around. Historically, if you want to have a look in Canada, Chalk River, the Chalk River project was an experimental reactor system, and it produced plutonium. And I think back in 1977, they gifted some plutonium to India for research. And one of the byproducts of that gift was India achieving the possession of nuclear bombs. So, it's let alone the health issues, you know, the sort of geopolitical problems and all the rest that it can be. So, UK is looking to move this thing up to 1,000 metres under the surface of the Earth that we're on, and sort of not store it. I mean, plutonium is kind of strange. I think it's got two or three uses. Strangely, plutonium is used for the batteries in heart pacemakers. It's been used in the International Space Station as a sort of central heating material. So it's used to warm them. It's really one of those things that's going to be around for thousands of years. So we keep coming back to these solutions. And obviously there's a move now to America's starting to wake up some of its dormant nuclear reactors for power. Obviously, we've talked about the sort of mini reactors that potentially could be used for domestic power in the UK. So interesting that 140 tons of this stuff to be processed and put underground, which seems to be a good thing. Probably save a bit of money and make things a bit safer. But just shows you the legacy from 1945 onwards. I think we've still got to come up with the means to deal with them.
Yeah, it's interesting stuff. All good stuff, PG. All being well. We'll speak to you Monday. Glory's Rock Show. One till three. More good stuff. All right, Paul.
Okay.
All right. Bye-bye, Paul. Bye.
Bye. Bye. Bye.
Great song there. Bits and Pieces by Dave Clotfire. We played that because RPG wasn't quite sure what he was going to talk about, so he did some bits and pieces. You're, of course, listening to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire, or sheffieldlive.org, talking about science in all its different forms every Saturday morning from 11 until 12. Next up, a quick reminder that this weekend is
the Big Garden Bird Watch. I know you've heard it on the TV, on the media,
because of the weather yesterday, yeah, might have put the little birds off.
So you've got today and tomorrow to take part in the UK's biggest garden wildlife survey by watching the birds for an hour between today and tomorrow. Last year, more than 600,000 people participated in the RSPB organised event. Grab a cuppa and record birds you see in your garden from your balcony or in a local park, then log them on the RSPB website. Go to the rspb.org.uk/birdwatch to find more details and how to do it.
Yeah, and do take part if you can, because it's a really interesting measure of what's happening with wildlife at the minute. All good stuff. Next up, this is a very interesting story I saw. It was written by the GP and author Dr. Rangan Chatterjee. He's got a new book out, and this was one of the suggestions for a better life and for all of us. Now, I think the book is geared towards men, but actually I think what I'm going to talk about now applies to everybody at some point. So he says, don't be grumpy. It causes chronic stress. He says, complaining regularly is bad for your health. First, you generate huge amounts of internal stress, which you then have to neutralise, often through unhealthy behaviours like sugar or alcohol. Now, chronic stress is thought to be behind 80 to 90% of what a medical doctor sees in any given day. Because it negatively impacts every single organ system in your body, your brain, your immune system, gut function, blood pressure and blood sugar. Second, if you're grumpy all the time, you risk alienating those around you. Every time you find yourself starting to complain, Dr. Chatterjee says, pause for a moment to see if you can reframe your complaint as a moment of gratitude, reminding yourself how much worse things could be, for example, or do something proactive. So instead of complaining about the situation, do something to make it better. And he says choosing gratitude will stop you thinking like a victim, and choosing action will stop you acting like one. So don't be grumpy. It causes chronic stress.
Yes, this could close down TripAdvisor.
Well, it could. Yeah, but it's a really interesting one, and we all do it. You know, we get grumpy about things, don't we? So don't do it.
Yes.
Think positive.
Yeah.
Next up, this week's environment update.
Bad news. Sorry. According to the Met Office, the rate at which atmospheric carbon dioxide is increasing is now incompatible with the 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial revolution levels global warming target set out in the Paris Agreement. In 2024, the burning of fossil fuels, deforestation and the weakening of carbon sinks due to the El Nino weather system push concentrations of the planet warming gas to 427 parts per million ppm. In May 2025, this figure is set to rise to 429.6 ppm, that's parts per million, the highest atmospheric CO2 gas concentration for over 2 million years.
Yikes.
Yikes.
Meanwhile, Thailand has banned the import of plastic waste in an attempt to tackle the scourge of plastic pollution and reduce its impact on public health. Thailand is one of the many Asian countries that has become a leading destination for exports of plastic waste from Europe, the US and Japan, with more than 1.1 million tonnes imported between 2018 and 2021.
Wow. Yeah. Solar farms across the US are benefiting from grazing sheep on their land, with the animals able to manage the grass and generate extra income for landowners. Agrivoltaics, which involves using land for both solar energy and agriculture, is becoming increasingly popular in the US. According to the American Solar Grazing Association, 27 states engage with the practice, and there are more than 60 projects across the country.
and a nature reserve in Essex that was created using more than 3 million tonnes of soil from the Cross Rail scheme is set to be enlarged by 100 hectares. Wallasey Island, which is managed by the RSPB, or Royal Society for Protection of Birds, provides habitat for multiple species of birds and seals. The expansion will include a lagoon for wading birds to raise their young and a large patchwork of grassland and scrub.
And a case of avian influenza, also known as bird flu, has been confirmed at a site in Shropshire. The government's Department for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs, DEFRA, confirmed a case in poultry at a premises near Wem on Monday. Although the site is in England, part of the surveillance zone extends into the Wrexham Local Authority area of Wales. Avian influenza or bird flu is primarily a disease of birds, and the risk to the general public's health is very low. Birds within protection zone cannot be kept outdoors, and there can be no movement of birds or eggs within or outside of the zone except under licence. Shropshire Council said owners of 50 or more birds had a legal requirement to add their flock to the poultry register on the government website.
And we've just got finally, before the film show come in, frogs, lizards, snakes, spiders and other insect pests are being transported across the world on cut flowers and potted plants, with potential to harm nature, according to scientists. These hitchhiking intruders have included a tree frog that emerged from roses imported from Colombia via Ecuador at a florist shop in Sheffield, can you believe? Researchers at the University of Cambridge are also concerned that imported flowers and plants could also contain invasive pests capable of causing severe damage to crops and the countryside. They are therefore calling for improved production standards and for data on specific risks from the trade to be collected and shared. That's all for this week. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye. We're going to play out with Bullfrog Blues. Rory Gallagher.
My brother got him. My sister got him. My brother got him.